often imitated, never duplicated. This is the one and only Fash the Nation, your guiding light in a sea of degeneracy.
Welcome to episode 205 of Fash the Nation. I'm Jazzy Hans McFields, joined as always by my trusty co-host Marcus Halberstam right here on the midweek show. Marcus, what's happening, dude?
Well, not too much, you know. No, there's all kinds of stuff happening, of course. You know, we got some court rulings on Remain in Mexico, the big powers for the cleaning house or not cleaning house at DHS, depending on who you listen to, and court rulings on Remain in Mexico, migrant numbers, you know, continuing to come in droves, record month after month. So, yeah, it's about the size of it.
Yeah, it's got quite a stack here to look at this week. I think, and then this weekend, we're going to have, Mr. Enoch on the weekend show, to talk about Kushner Inc., which if you haven't listened to our first two episodes on this subject, 202 and 204, in the right smack dab in the middle of the episode, you have a breakdown of this book, Kushner Inc. by Vicky Ward. One of the most important books I think that has been written in a long time. So definitely check out this weekend show. We're going to be talking about that and other things. But curious timing, Halberstam, because you and I roasted the shit out of what I now believe is pronounced Kirstjen Nielsen. Finally, after she's gone, I get her name right for once. I've been saying Kristjen or Kristjen because I thought it was just a Nordicized version of the name Christian. But it is, for the very first time, I noticed that the I comes before the R. So Mike is right. It is Kirstjen Nielsen. And she has sullied her heritage. I do stand by that.
Yeah. I'm the one that started the Kristjen thing. And then not too long after, I realized it wasn't correct. I just was sort of used to saying it at that point. And I was just kind of like, it don't matter.
Yeah, it's whatever. Yeah. So, I mean, it was very prescient that we roasted her in the first 20 minutes of our show on Sunday. And then by Sunday night, she was gone. I honestly didn't think that was going to happen. I mean, my expectations of the Trump administration right now are at such rock bottom lows. I think I said when we roasted her that she needs to get axed or she should be axed or whatever. But I had no belief that that was going to happen. I sort of gave up on that. At Christmas when there was that big ouster of literally everybody else and she didn't go.
Yeah. She definitely was exposed in her interview with Tucker. He was going to town on her. Like I'm sure many a dude did when she was, you know, 20, 25 years old.
Yeah, probably.
And you know, Trump, you know, was probably watching it as it happened. And then heard all about it from whatever sectors he pays attention to these days.
Yeah, well, and so I thought, you know, I said this on the Monday Tedious. I wandered onto there for a little while to give my immediate takes, like the immediate 24-hour takes. And I have some additional takes on this now, especially as like new stories have come out about what has been going on in the background, because my initial take was extremely like low expectations. Boomer Trump finally got tired of Kirstjen's bullshit. He saw the interview and had enough. But the reality is we were kind of, and that may be true, some of that, but more of the reality is that as the week has unfolded, it's been clear that this has been the culminating moment, or at least the beginning of a culminating moment in this inner administration struggle between the pro-Jared Kushner forces and the anti-Jared Kushner forces. And based on what I'm seeing, I mean, Stephen Miller essentially is the guy that he's been pushing for this forever. And I guess Trump wanted to give deference to Jared and let him continue to work out, you know, whatever he's trying to work out stupidly, wrongly, the things that we've criticized him most vociferously on. And it turns out that all that blew up in Kushner's face, it sounds like. And Miller basically has been placed in charge of the whole operation at this point. And the first checkbox on the list was get this bitch the fuck out of here, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, her interview with Tucker once again, but all of her interviews, you know, the vocal fry, her obviously cavalier attitude, toward the country being invaded, you know, it had become untenable. It was, her presence was untenable, you know, even without everything going on at the border. Yeah, she definitely had to go. That's the word on the street. I mean, that's certainly all the hand wringing from these liberal rags, you know, and also, you know, GOP Congress critters is that, you know, oh, God.
Yeah, we'll get to that a little bit later here shortly. But yeah, Kirstjen Nielsen's departure from Homeland Security. I mean, even like the New York Times wrote an op-ed on Tuesday, who is left to say no to Trump? And, you know, I think the common refrain on this is essentially that they have tried a number of times to sort of rein him in with various figures. She sort of stupidly put it out there that she had figured out the winning formula, which is like, just tell the president what he wants to hear, and everything's going to be fine and it's going to be great. Well, that worked for a while, probably a lot longer than it should have. And it's now, it just has reached the point where she was called into the White House on Sunday night at like 5 o'clock. And I don't know whether the plan was to fire her then, but apparently it got very contentious and she resigned / was fired or whatever. But I mean, how many times do you have to sit in a meeting with this bitch looking across the Resolute desk or wherever the meeting was and listen to her just spout the bullshit that she was doing on Tucker? I mean, you don't have to have a 135 IQ to see that she's just fucking bullshitting you and that she doesn't know what she's doing. And it's a combination of incompetence and she's trying to seem like she's got all the answers that Trump wants to hear. I mean, you can tell very quickly when someone's like doing that to you, like a guy trying to sell you like a shitty used car.
Yeah. Normally, I mean, if you're someone who doesn't want yes men, you know, coming into your office, one of your subordinates coming in and doing that whole bit. If you're a guy who wants that. You know, and Trump definitely seems to be one of those guys. That's why it was, you know, working for so long. But then eventually he was like, wait a minute, I'm getting fucking killed here with all this immigration and my base. Like this woman is literally killing me right now.
Yeah. The combination of him believing that he's getting answers that he wants to hear and then going out and doing the bit in his speeches and it just not matching up with reality at all. I mean, you know, like we said this weekend, you know, with the golf cheat accusations, it's like Trump is used to being able to just go into the woods and give his ball a nice kick out onto the middle of the fairway. You know, if it moves up the fairway 50 yards, like all the better. And he can't do that as president. And all of this caught up with him. I mean, in business, he can have people sort of paper over the results if they're not good. But you can't do that. You can't paper over 1.5 million non-white third world dregs streaming into the southern border of the United States. You can't paper over that. It doesn't work.
Yeah, staring you in the face on television. Yeah, this was a piece by Mother Jones. They were sort of having a meltdown over this. Thwarted on immigration, Trump is firing everyone. You know, and then it goes into how the Washington Post apparently reported last week that Trump has told Stephen Miller that he is now in charge of all immigration and border policy. With the number of families crossing the southern border at a record high, Miller is deflecting blame away from the White House and on to DHS. On Friday, he succeeded in getting Trump to pull Ronald Vitiello, who the ICE union was also very much against. That was sort of a pleasant surprise. There are people who, like Numbers USA is sort of questioning some of these moves, but they're, I think, willing to give the president the benefit of the doubt. Obviously, something just has to change here.
I mean, Vitiello had been in place at ICE for 3 decades. And, you know, he has, you know, he, you could make the argument that ICE has been doing some of its job because it's obviously gotten the ire of the left in terms of, you know, the abolish ICE and all those like raids and everything else. But clearly they're not doing enough. If you just look at it by the numbers, I mean, ICE is not nearly deporting the number of people that it should be on a on a very rapid basis. It's just not doing its work. And Vitiello is probably resistant. I noticed the acting DHS secretary, another whammon. She also resigned. You know, they're now, Miller is pushing Trump to fire Lee Francis Cisna, which I thought was somewhat surprising. But when you hear the reasons why, it makes a lot more sense. I mean, they've been pushing on USCIS. He's the head of USCIS for how they handle the asylum claims. Essentially, he wanted Cisna to hand that over to CBP instead of USCIS, because USCIS hands them employment forms. They basically do the job of all these NGOs. And also they're not using what they call this country condition comparison. So it's like, how bad is your country really? And, you know, basing that on, you know, the gravity of their asylum claim. And Miller basically wanted them to ditch all of that and started to use metrics that are, say, like, yeah, actually, you know, your asylum, you don't really have a credible fear here. This is bullshit. And for 6 months, Cisna resisted, just ignored all fucking requests. So I was kind of surprised at first, because Cisna is also the guy who rewrote the USCIS credo to be like white nationalist rhetoric. But that may very well have just been Miller saying, hey, Frank, fucking here's your new fucking slogan. Make sure it's up on the website by sundown.
Yeah, yeah, it probably was. I mean, because before it was sort of exactly how you laid out. It was very, very service oriented toward these migrants.
It might as well have been. It might as well have been the Statue of Liberty poem. It basically went from the Statue of Liberty poem to the 14 words, essentially. I don't even remember what it was, but it was very, if you go read the actual USCIS slogan now, it's like very based, and they were very upset about it. I just don't have it in front of me.
Yeah. So there's also amid all these reports about this power struggle between Stephen Miller and Jared Kushner, the good witch and the bad witch, I guess. They're saying that Trump is supposedly wanting to reinstate the child separation policy, which is they're saying that was potentially the big bone of contention between him and Nielsen. Now that's obviously all speculation, but it makes sense. I mean, if the administration really is looking to go back to that, fine. It did work. That's something that we've been saying, that the biggest problem with child separation is that it stopped. But if Trump goes back to that, he needs to be prepared to stay the course, and it's going to be hot and heavy from both the media and Jared and Ivanka. But if he stays the course, for a period of time, probably like a quarter, I would say, the numbers will demonstrably go down, and then he can just be like, look, it works. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, I mean, there are always a number of really great arguments in favor of the separation policy. The fact that it is the law, it is what is supposed to be done. And, you know, that it was Melania and some other, Jared and Ivanka, basically complaining about the bad optics that led him to basically write that executive order stopping it. And then that executive order was thrown out. And then the whole policy has just come to a screeching halt. So it's like, no, dude, like this is something that needs to happen. I don't know why he's going out and sort of saying, oh, Obama did that. I think you have that audio, don't you, of him making some statements today?
Yeah, I don't know that it was today, but he did come out and blame it on Obama, but then say, but it worked, though.
Obama separated the children, by the way. Just so you understand, President Obama separated the children. Those cages that were shown, I think they were very inappropriate. They were built by President Obama's administration, not by Trump. President Obama had child separation. Take a look. The press knows it. You know it. We all know it. I'm the one that stopped it. President Obama had child separation. Now, I'll tell you something. Once you don't have it, that's why you see many more people coming. They're coming like it's a picnic, because let's go to Disneyland. President Obama separated children. They had child separation. I was the one that changed it. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, so it's sort of somewhat unclear whether or not, you know, he seems to be like, this is the law, this is what we're going to be doing. Obama did it, though. He seems to, I don't know, it doesn't seem like he's sort of walking away from it. But, you know, this is, you know, I was going to say this at the beginning. All of this stuff, including what we're about to talk about with this Jared versus Stephen article in McClatchy. It's this sort of starts like a 30-day timer. Actually, it's like just a timer in perpetuity of how long is this going to be the new big, tough, aggressive Trump? Is it going to be 4 days? Is it going to be 10 days? Is it going to be until the other shoe drops? So this is all great news. I look at this as a significant white pill that there has been a victory, it seems like, of Stephen Miller over over Jared Kushner. But how long will that last? How long, you know, is Trump's exasperation with what's going on in the border short lived? He fires Nielsen. He feels better. Jared gets in his ear over the course of 72 hours, over the course of a week. And then what? So this is great. It's great news. It shows that, you know, that it's all is not lost, it seems, in this battle. But how long will it last? I mean, the media was flipping out about Stephen Miller being put in charge of immigration. And I thought it was great what has been happening on that front.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's very good. But I don't know. It's you get the feeling that however this pans out, it's going to be the final showdown with Miller and Jared Kushner. It's going to be one of those two go in, one comes out type of deals.
Yeah, well, let's dig into this McClatchy article. So this is from McClatchy. This is from yesterday, I think. So President Donald Trump's choice of Stephen Miller to lead on immigration sets up a potential policy clash with one of the most influential people in the White House, president's son-in-law. The move comes as Trump, focused on challenges in securing the border, sent Jared Kushner back to the drawing board to develop new ideas on immigration reform after being unsatisfied with the results of an initial proposal for legal immigration framework, according to two sources familiar with the talks.
It's the latest power shift in just a few months after Kushner, who is married to Ivanka, had emerged as the new figurehead trying to come up with a plan to fix the legal immigration system following his quote unquote success on criminal justice legislation. The clock is ticking on all this stuff, said a former Trump official who remains in contact with people inside the White House. There is no way that Stephen can continue to push a very hard right restrictionist policy and for Jared to be pushing a middle of the road, slightly left of center policy, and something doesn't come in conflict. Yeah, hopefully.
Well, yeah. And I mean, obviously, you know, this adds some context to the article that we read a couple months ago where it said Stephen Miller is playing a long game within the administration, because it says later in this article, and I don't remember where, but it says something to the effect that Stephen is not going to sacrifice his position in the White House in order to sort of overcome. I don't know. He doesn't want to have a showdown with Jared. He just wants to fucking win. He's highly strategic. He says Stephen is highly strategic on this, and he doesn't want to sacrifice his position, which is, I mean, I get that time is of the essence, but I mean, Bannon essentially sacrificed his position and he's gone. I mean, it would be great to have a blow up, but if the last man standing is Jared Kushner, like it's over. And if Stephen Miller's goal is to play the long game to the point where We're now at I guess a point where he can get Nielsen out and get some of these policies, but I'm just afraid it's all going to get stuck in the mud. I don't want to be overly white pilled. I also don't want to be overly black pilled either, given what we know. But my sort of position on this is like, this all sounds great, but the timer has started on when the other shoe is going to drop and when meaningful action will actually get taken. I mean, Christian Nielsen being fired and cleaning house at DHS is meaningful action. What comes next? I'm not sure. But the fact that this story is talking about how frustrated Trump was with this presentation. So it goes, they had the meeting. The presentation was made, said a source familiar with the discussion. Trump became frustrated. He's very frustrated over the border crisis also. And he felt that what made it to his desk was just not good enough and not what he wanted to do. He's very vexed by this border crisis and saw that he needed to give clear direction. The idea is they're going to put something together that can become a theme for the administration going forward to the election. And it's like, yeah, Jared, like, brings some scribble on a notepad that says, like, more brown people and also more brown people. And you have to, like, chill on the border. And it's like, get the fuck out of here, Jared. Like, essentially, it fits the pattern of what we've seen so far, which is that the Kushners have this habit of fucking overdoing it in every respect. And Jared just, like, jewed too hard. And now the end result is Trump basically said, get the fuck out of here. I mean, I don't know how this is. I'm glad it happened if it's true, but.
Yeah, Jude, too hard yet in a very shitty way. You know, I was thinking about this yesterday. Stephen Miller is like the, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, their policy preference here. Like, he is the better Jew, like, between the two of them. Like, he is the Jew's Jew, aside from, you know, what they both want for America. You know, so. I don't know. That's part of the reason that my money's on him, to tell you the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, money on Miller to win out. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I think he will. He's much more intelligent. I mean, that was the big thing in the Kushner Inc. book, is that Jared, we didn't really dive into this too much because there was so much to talk about with that book. But a common theme within the book is how incompetent Jared is. No matter whether he is trying to rehab the Observer newspaper or wade out into immigration or criminal justice reform and all this other shit. He's just, the only thing that Jared Kushner is extremely knowledgeable about is Israel. That's, everybody says that, like, unanimously in the book, it's Israel is his thing. He knows this really well. But there's this one section in the book where he and Bannon are having a conversation outside of the elevator, and Bannon starts talking to him about digital media. You know, Bannon not really knowing Jared that well and just thinking, oh, this guy owns the New York Observer, like, one of my favorite papers. Like, certainly this guy is going to be, you know, really knowledgeable. And Bannon says, like, within a few minutes, he's like, it was then I realized, like, this guy doesn't know anything about, like, fucking anything. Like, he's just totally incompetent, which is kind of, you don't expect that, but I see why your money's on Miller, because he's just, when you hear, I mean, dude, Miller's just like, when you hear this guy fucking go at it on these issues, it's just like, this guy knows this stuff top to bottom very well. High verbal IQ. Yeah. That's what you expect.
Yeah. High verbal IQ with, combined with a sort of laser, like, even Spurg, like, you might say, yes, ability to be obsessive and just recite stuff and have a mastery of all the arguments.
He does have, like, an element of Spurg in him. Like, there is the Spurg strain is strong in Stephen Miller. Like, you can tell.
Yeah. So after this little proposal pitch meeting that they had, after meeting last week, things are moving in the opposite direction of immigration increases and betrayal of campaign promises, said the person familiar with the discussion. less than a week, they got rid of Nielsen and pulled Vitiello's nomination to lead ICE. On Tuesday, senior administration officials said U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, this is what you were alluding to before, the Department of Homeland Security agency that handles legal immigration, quote unquote, dropped the ball for not taking steps to more rigorously scrutinize asylum cases for getting to cross-reference credible fear claims against country conditions. It's like, I know your country's shitty, but are you going to do?
Let's be real here. And then, this article goes on to say, it certainly represents a blow to one of the top legislative goals of Jared, who is hoping to use immigration reform to better his personal relationship with some of the top CEOs and tech leaders in America. Yeah, it's like, dude, Jared is so dumb. Jared is so incompetent. That, like, he knows what he wants because he's a Jew. He wants to subvert. It's like his natural part of who he is. And his father is trying to guide him as best he can. You know, Charles is actually an intelligent guy, at least to the point where, you know, he can fucking get what he wants when he wants it. But Jared's just so bad at it. And Jared is so obvious, like, in what he's trying to do. It's like, you know, it's like he doesn't even think about the fact that what's it going to take to get Trump to reverse course on all these things. And look what it's done. Look what it's done. It's like, Trump came out and bitch slapped Ann Coulter, and he shouldn't have. It was disgraceful, as you put it. But I wonder the private conversations that go on. Does Trump realize? It's like, yes, I've lost Ann Coulter. Tucker just tore this DHS secretary apart. Like, how long? What's going to happen when I start losing these people? And how bad are things going to get? And it's like, dude, every bad thing that's happened in this administration has been because of Jared and Ivanka. Just imagine if they weren't there. If basically Miller is running the show full time, what happens? And I don't know. I don't know. I think the correct move for Trump is fire Jared, obviously. Get rid of the kids for once and for fucking all. But barring that, like, send the guy to Israel to, like, help out with Bibi or some shit. Like, if you're going to be a Zionist, like, make Kushner your fucking Zion czar and get him the fuck out of the country. Like, come on.
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously we're talking about everything that's going on in the Democratic primary. That's sort of the highlight of our coverage, some people might say. So, I mean, the election season is, it's going to really start heating up soon. And Jared Kushner, he needs to make this decision sooner rather than later. This guy can't be around. It's not just us that doesn't like him. I mean, you can go to Boomer Bard or whatever. And, you know, they don't like Ivanka. They can't really articulate it. But they know
they know there's something that they don't like, just like people know that there's something not to like about Adam Schiff. Like Rush Limbaugh and all these other guys are going way out of their way. You know, they describe Adam Schiff's appearance, you know, this pencil neck, bulging eyes. It's like, come on, man, quit fucking dancing around. Like, everybody knows why they don't like Adam Schiff. They just can't put it right on
him. Know. And Nadler are the two main henchmen. And it's like, and you get it. It's like, these guys, you know, they have no choice. Like, they have to just leave that hanging out there over the plate. Well, not us.
No, not us at all. This article goes on. Late last year, Kushner helped kick off a fresh discussion on immigration that reflected a new paradigm in the White House. That new direction was reflected in Trump's ad-libbed comment about increasing legal immigration during the February State of the Union. This was like really the beginning of just total heading into the bowels of black pill mode because of this. And, you know, this is something. It appeared to be a shift away from the priorities of 2017, Trump's first year in office, that sought to blah, 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 blah. These concerns about the growing influence of corporate executives on the White House led groups like the Federation for American Immigration Reform, FAIR, to launch a new ad reminding Trump of his Buy American, Hire American agenda. One of the first images in the ad was of Kushner below the headline, "Can the Koch Network and Jared Kushner come up with a big immigration reform deal?" Miller's recent ascendancy on immigration is seen as a return to the core issues that got Trump elected. Oh, this is the quote that I was looking for. Kushner's involvement was kind of boutique and novel, like going out for a Heineken. Whereas when you're talking about Stephen Miller, it's always Miller time. Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely is always Miller time. Our prayers are with Stephen Miller, if he'll accept them. Yeah. I mean, if it was just, you know, Bannon and Stephen Miller and these people had never been around, things would be so much better. And I hope that Stephen Miller has been like, look, you know, maybe phrase it, you know, a little more gently or not in so many words or whatever. But, you know, let him know, like, if there's anything that is going to jeopardize your chances of reelection, which are very good, you know, I must say right now, based on everything that I see. The only thing that's the thing that's going to jeopardize that most surely and quickly is you continuing to listen to either him or your fucking daughter. Now, yeah. I'm sure he would leave Ivanka out of it because Trump, you know, just can't handle anyone saying anything like that, which is the reason number one why she shouldn't fucking be there.
Yeah, no, they all have to go. And, you know, there may be some push to get Jared involved with the campaign. Jared needs to be just uninvolved with everything. Go ahead.
Yeah, I remembered what I was going to say. So, I mean, Mr. Art of the Deal, you know, obviously the negotiations begin with your starting point. And this is not, you know, you don't need to be Mr. Dealmaker to understand this. It's just, you know, haggling. So, you know, Kushner and this whole working group, you know, that put together that they put together, you know, including Chamber of Commerce and Coke shills and all these people looking for a quote unquote grand bargain, comprehensive immigration reform. Everyone knows what that means. Like, your starting bid is going to be like almost everything that they want. So what the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the problem, and because that's the starting bid, and because everybody, including us, knows that it's the starting bid, so do the fucking migrants and everybody else that's been streaming up here. Like, I hope Trump realizes, or I hope in hindsight that he realizes that the more legal immigrants for the factories bit, like we said when it was first said, this is tantamount to amnesty because you're inviting people to come in. And you have no, you're basically, you're saying that we need more workers and you have no way to stop anyone from coming in. So it's just fucking totally stupid. And he has to realize now that he himself has made this problem worse. Like you said, the Democrats are not wrong about the charge that he himself has made the crisis worse. You know, for different reasons, we believe this than they do, but. Yeah, it's this whole thing could have all been avoided, and the opening bid should have not been everything these fucking people wanted. But it had to get this bad, I guess. It had to get this bad. The reality is like, how does he not see it? I don't know. It's just this part in the book, the Vicky Ward book, that can't be explained about his frustrations with Kushner. The biggest black pill is that, yes, he goes ballistic on Jared a lot. And then a day or two later, it's just like that was that. Now, hopefully Miller being installed as like the single guy in charge of this immigration from now on will represent a sea change where Jared really isn't involved. But I don't know how that's going to work out. I hope Stephen Miller sort of takes some ownership over this territory and does his best to keep Jared as uninvolved as possible. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah. I hope to see Mr. Miller's smiling face or not smiling face oftentimes on the Sunday shows. It concerns me when I don't see him anywhere for a while. And, you know, obviously Mr. Kushner is ubiquitous.
Yeah.
Well, so,
well, hold on before we pivot, though. So this is the point that I wanted to make on. Oh, go ahead. Good.
No. You go ahead.
Miller. So Jared Kushner, we know the pattern. We've talked about this at length. All of the negative media coverage on Jared or on Stephen Miller has been a result of Jared Kushner. Jared Kushner, they like this is also discussed in the book. And we didn't talk about it, but Jared Kushner and Ivanka hired an army of PR publicists. Nobody working in the White House has ever hired their own publicist. That's usually run through the White House comms office. They hired their own publicists when they got into the big war with Steve Bannon over like leaks and planting shitty stories and Steve, the great manipulator, the puppet master, blah, 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 blah. They're now going to do the same thing to Stephen Miller. And they blamed, this was from the, within a couple hours of Christian Nielsen being fired, this was the narrative. And they blamed everybody. They blamed it all on Stephen Miller. And now they're trying to frame Stephen Miller as like the guy that's in charge of it all. And this is a montage, a little media montage of the media with their marching orders from Jared Kushner.
The president reportedly turns over immigration policy to Stephen Miller.
Engineered and directed by immigration hardliner Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller is reportedly consolidating his control over administration policy.
Stephen Miller is playing a key role.
The dark lord of anti-immigration, Stephen Miller.
This is apparently being led by Stephen Miller.
Driven in large part by Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller, immigration hardliner.
Immigration hardliner, Stephen Miller.
We're talking about 33-year-old Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller.
Because of Stephen Miller. Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller.
Kirsten Nielsen was pushed out by Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller pulling the strings like this from his perch.
Stephen Miller. His white nationalist tendencies are really obvious.
Stephen Miller is said to be the driving force.
Yeah. Dude, just nonstop blaming him for everything. I mean, I hope that he has that much power. I really do.
Yeah. Once again, may all these people's worst fears come true. But he's, I'm sure that Mr. Kushner and his advanced PR machine, that's one of the things he seems to understand, aside from Israel, is, leaking and manipulating the media and stirring up fucking chaos in the Trump administration. I hope that all these people's worst fears are realized, but it's not just the Kushner wing of the White House. It's also some of these GOP Congress critters have mentioned Miller specifically in their reaction, in their, just appallingly shit tier reaction to all this. Looking at you, John Cornyn and Chuck Grassley and others, there were very few bright spots, unfortunately, and this just demonstrates where things are still with the GOP establishment and the big wigs in the Senate and so forth.
Yeah. Chuck Grassley, there were several pieces on Chuck Grassley that are extremely rustling. I mean, Chuck Grassley has been in Congress for 7 terms as a United States Senator, 42 years. This fucking guy. And what has he done for the people of Iowa? See, Chuck Grassley is like one of these guys that I was talking about within the last few months, where if you look at deep red states within the country, and you would expect to have senators that are the right wing equivalent of people like Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Kristen Gillibrand, like these stalwarts of liberalism, progressive liberalism. But you don't have that in these deep red states. You have people like Chuck Grassley, who won his last election by 500,000 votes. That should give him in Iowa 500,000 votes. That's like Des Moines and the Quad Cities and probably one other fucking place out there. It's like this guy won by 500,000 votes. That should give him all the leeway in the world that he needs to get rid of every single fucking illegal immigrant in his entire state. The blood of now I can't even remember her name. God
Molly
damn it.
Tibbetts.
Molly Tibbetts. Yes. Molly Tibbetts is on Chuck Grassley's hands. The blood of Molly Tibbetts is on Chuck Grassley's hands. And all, and he benefits from this. Of course, this is why he's taking this position. He benefits from all the illegal immigrant labor. And he's been there for 42 years. The people of Iowa deserve someone more like Steve King. The people in these deep red states deserve someone who is going to be like, actually, where are the senators that come out to the right of Donald Trump? That's really where what we need to have in these states. People that come out and say, Mr. President, it's time to fire your fucking son-in-law. the people of Iowa deserve better. But no, you have Chuck Grassley who comes out and says, I think it would be hard for Stephen Miller to demonstrate he's accomplished anything for the president. How fucking dare you, Chuck? You fucking bungled the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. You fucking bungled those.
I was going to mention that.
Fucking piece of shit. He bungled the shit out of that. Like, giving the Democrats as much rope to hang Kavanaugh with as they want. While this guy, like, blah, 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 he's like a senile fucking old guy. But he's got the balls to come out and talk shit on everything to do with Trump's immigration. I mean, he's lamenting all the people being fired and how horrible it's going to be for the DHS. All of a sudden, this guy's concerned with the safety and the security of the country. Fuck you, Chuck. Fuck you. This guy doesn't deserve another term. He got reelected in 2016. 2022 is coming quick, Chuck. Fucking piece of shit.
Yeah, the president has to have some stability, and particularly with the number one issue that he's made for his campaign throughout his 2.5 years of his presidency, Grassley told, I assume, the Washington Post. He's pulling the rug out from the very people that are trying to help him accomplish his goal. It's like, dude, you're seeing these people help the president ostensibly accomplish his goal on the television every day with, you know, squad of Mollins fucking bum rushing the border and you know, yanking their children around by the arms, running from tear gas and shit. Much deserved tear gas, mind you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He says he told the Washington Post that these people are good public servants. And then herein lies the rub. Secondly, well, besides the personal connection I have with these people, you know, these are the people that I want to, you know, these are the people that have great qualifications to help with the president. It's like, accomplish what? What have these people done to help the president accomplish his agenda? It's they've done the opposite. That's why Chuck likes them. You notice how many hit pieces have there been on Kirstjen Nielsen? Have there been any? Anything? I mean, they'll act like, you know, she was responsible for child separations or whatever, but. Oh, dude, they were so rustled when she got fired because she's like the thing. She's like Jared's woman at DHS. Everything's fine. Now she's gone.
Yeah, it's the only real negative articles that I've seen about her, you know, have been in the last couple days since she has been let go, or it became apparent that, you know, that she was let go. It's like, oh, you know, this is going to be your legacy, blah, blah, blah. And you're never going to be rehabilitated and get into polite circles, which, I mean, for a bitch like Nielsen, this is like that is like the worst thing that you could tell her. So that's, you know, definitely kind of a shiv from her perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, this article also says, and this just shows what a fucking little snake fucking Grassley is. When asked about Grassley's concerns with the departures, a spokesperson said that the senator raised the issue with members of the White House. Senator Grassley hasn't spoken to the president directly. Of course not, because you're a fucking faggot cuck on this issue, but has expressed his concerns to White House staff. Yeah, Jared Kushner. What other White House staff have you expressed your concerns to, Chuck? Fucking piece of shit. Been in the Senate since 1981. What have you done, Chuck? I was looking into Chuck Grassley. I did see that in 1984. In 1984, Chuck Grassley voted against Martin Luther King Day becoming a national holiday. I was like, wow, fucking based. And then it's been all downhill from there, I guess.
Oh, yeah. No, that was totally a thing. Like you wouldn't, you know, some Zoomer listening to this, I'm sure could hardly believe it. Dude, I want to say even fucking Biden voted against it at one point.
Oosh, it's going to come out to bite him, possibly.
Yeah. I mean, don't quote me on that. For some reason, it sticks in my mind that might be something that he was involved in. Yeah. So, I mean, this was an article in The Hill. GOP senators raise concerns about Miller's ascension.
They raise deep concerns. Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. I hope that he's got more voices than that one in his ear on these issues, because, yeah, I think it's important that he get a whole perspective and range of opinions, said Senator John Thune. Pressed on who else the president should also be listening to, Thune added with a chuckle, some of them are now gone. Yeah, fucking good, faggot. John Cornyn, a member of the GOP leadership, said Miller appears to be the guy behind the curtain, quote unquote. I think what we need is a consistent message, because I think there are some voices in the White House who are working counter to that message, and particularly creating more problems for the administration by losing senior leadership, Cornyn said when asked if he had concerns about Miller's growing influence. Reports that Miller wants to oust Lee Cisna, head of USCIS, are putting him at odds with Chuck Grassley. GOP senator called acting White House chief of staff Mick Mulvaney, and that must have been who he was talking about this weekend, to make the case for keeping Cisna, a former Grassley staffer, and Kathy Newbel Kovarik, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that doesn't matter. I know Cisna well. I know Kathy Kovarik well. They're qualified people. They're good for the president, said Grassley. I heard they were going to be dismissed, and that irritates me. Churn is not helpful to Trump or DHS, said John Cornyn. It creates more churning and takes more oxygen out of the environment. Like, what the fuck does that even? It takes more oxygen out of the environment. It's like what these people are doing is not good.
Yeah. And these people have, like, the GOP always is there. They're always the ones to complain and have these deep concerns whenever things are going well. That's how you know. That's like sort of the tell that this stuff with Miller is actually a big white pill. At least that's how I measure it, because you have the media fucking schvitzing themselves to death over it. You have people arm waving about Kirstjen Nielsen, and then you have the full, it's like all the people that are sticking their necks out right now are the guys that need to get the fuck out of Washington. John Thune, John Cornyn, Chuck Grassley. Lindsey Graham is silent because Lindsey Graham has already admitted that he's played the game. Or did I miss a quote from Lindsey Graham on this? Graham is playing the fucking
No. That's Graham has been remarkably silent about this. Now that you mention it, I don't recall seeing any reacts from him to any of this.
Well, because he is the conduit in Congress through which all this immigration shit flows with Kushner. Like they know, like Lindsey's plan is to just schmooze the president and do basically what Kirstjen Nielsen was doing. Now, at a certain point, that's going to stop working. I hope Trump figures that out sooner rather than later, because at some point, and I'm going to make this prediction right here and right now, you will see Lindsey Graham turn on Donald Trump in a way just like he had before, in all the ways that he did before. You're going to see that happen because Donald, if Donald hasn't realized this already, Lindsey's playing the game. Donald probably realized it the second that article was written. And that's probably why you saw Graham like being more critical of Trump, because it's like, yeah, it's like the president. One day you're going to get Lindsey Graham on television. The president is no longer taking my phone calls. I don't know. I haven't talked to him in weeks. It's like, yeah, dude, because you fucked up.
Yeah. yeah, he really did. Speaking of senators from deep red states doing the wrong thing, this also was from The Hill. GOP Kansas senator warns Senate would not confirm Kobach as DHS secretary. Don't go there. We can't confirm him. Pat Roberts told the Kansas City Star when asked about Kobach's prospects for the nomination. I never said that to you, Roberts reportedly added, despite another reporter being present and the Star not having agreed to an off the record conversation. Kobach is also considering running for Roberts' seat when the senator retires in 2020, according to the Star. I have supported Chris Kobach in the past, and I have supported every one of Trump's nominees, but ultimately this will be the president's decision, Roberts said in a statement following the story's publication.
Yeah, see, Roberts is yet another one of these guys who he's a senator from Kansas. He is the senior senator in Kansas. He's been there since 1997. He was last elected in 2014. This is a place where he has never received less than 60% of the vote. Never received less than 60% of the vote. I mean, this is like this guy. This is yet another senator like Chuck Grassley that does not belong in Kansas. But the NRSC has done such a phenomenal job of controlling who makes it through the primaries in these states that it makes it impossible for anyone else but some kosher fucking pick to make it through. And that's what you have in these deep red states. This is one of the problems. In these deep red states, you have senators who would otherwise imagine how many senators that there would be. This is always the chief complaint of Democrats, is they can't crack the Senate because of this antiquated white supremacist system of government. But imagine if these senators who are cucks in these deep red states were actually more like Steve King adjacent. What would that be like? Could you imagine if you had that many people? I mean, I hate to keep hitting this point, but it's true. It's like another one in the same podcast. Fucking guy, Pat Roberts.
Yeah, certainly they should be, you know, and maybe it's because of the lack of diversity in these places. Like in a white country, like, yeah, you can, you know, you can put these guys into the Senate to LARP about, you know, fiscal responsibility or getting rid of Obamacare and, you know, whatever the fuck. It's, you know, there is that dynamic of people not being exposed to diversity, you know, despite the Democrats and some of these, you know, Christian refugee resettlement organizations' best efforts. They don't understand the existential nature of the struggle that we currently are locked into. So you get these people like Grassley, but
they you know, started hopefully some there's of them. New... Some of them started off okay, though. Like Roberts voted against Reagan's 86 amnesty bill. But then in 2018, he comes out as one of these 13 Republican senators that signed a letter sent to Jeff Sessions requesting a moratorium on the Trump administration family separation policy. So some of these guys actually started off OK. But over time, I mean, it's like you just take a look at what Pat Roberts' net worth is now and Chuck Grassley's net worth. I mean, Chuck Grassley was a fucking like working class guy and he's worth like $3.5 million now. It's like, how does this happen? And that's what he reports, $3.5 million anyway.
Yeah, well, I don't know. When you make $174,000 a year and insider trading is not illegal, like I was talking about with Joe Biden, it becomes kind of difficult not to walk away with a few million.
Yeah, well, and Joe Biden somehow has not been able to do that at all. So, I mean, going back to this whole thing, I saw today, I don't think you have this in the stack because it's so new, but maybe I don't even have it in the stack because this isn't working the way I wanted it to. But anyway, there's an article like from about an hour ago that said Trump was asked by reporters on whether or not he had considered Kris Kobach for DHS secretary. And Trump said, oh, I hadn't really thought of that. So I haven't heard the audio. I only read the article. I don't know if Trump is being coy. I don't know the context. I don't know how it was framed or whatever. But the headline of the article and the text of the article seemed to convey that Trump indicated he had not considered Kobach for DHS secretary. And it's like in dozens of conversations with Stephen Miller, like this has never come up who you're going to pick. I mean, this is what I was talking about with Tedious Guys on Monday. It's like, if I were Stephen Miller and my goal was to get rid of Kirstjen Nielsen, I would not do so unless I had a firm person picked for that position. So I don't know what the plan is there because it can always. Yeah. Mike said,
otherwise, you're going to feed into this like chaos narrative and, you know, and the churn that Chuck Grassley, you know, was talking about. And if you're not going to come out with somebody better on the other side, it is pretty fruitless. So, you know, well, I hope that's Trump's bullshitting. I mean, the three that are in, you know, the running, I guess, are obviously Kobach and heard you guys talking about Ken Cuccinelli on Tedious.
And yeah, Ken Cuccinelli.
Apparently Tom Homan is also up for consideration, which I certainly would be. I'd prefer Kobach. But, you know, Homan has proved to be a very solid guy after, you know, his service in the Trump administration as an Obama appointee and yeah, Cuccinelli is, well, everything that you guys said and everything that you and I have said and everything that everyone who's worth a shit has said about Ken Cuccinelli.
Yeah, I don't think he'll be considered. As I recall, I don't even think I think Cuccinelli was he was anti-Trump. So that's going to be one of the biggest reasons that.
He was trying to pull some shit on the floor at the convention, which Ann Coulter has pointed out, which that Mother Jones article pointed out also.
Yeah.
So, if it's Trump's memory for slights that prevented him from aligning with Mo Brooks, yeah, then this ought to fucking be disqualifying, bud.
Yeah, I think he would remember this. Yeah, this is from July of 2016. Their scheme came together on the fly. Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah, who became a vocal Never Trump advocate last week, met throughout the afternoon with a small group of conspirators, including former Virginia Attorney General Kenan Cuccinelli and Colorado delegate Kendall Unruh. At the back of the convention floor, they eventually rounded up the support of 8 states, plus Washington, D.C., 2 more than necessary, blah, 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 blah. They handed off their petition. Nah, 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 nah. Yeah, so he's been part of this all along. So that's hopefully Trump remembers.
Mike Lee. Yeah, I remember when that guy was, pushed as something. I remember in like 2010, John Thune was pushed as somebody up and coming. Now, I don't remember if he was a member of the vaunted Young Guns.
He might
have, or maybe that was just house guys.
I think it was just house guys. But Thune was definitely one of the people that they inserted as a Tea Party guy. And you could tell that he didn't even really embrace. He didn't really want to embrace that. But Thune,
I mean, he's a legit looking dude, like many of these guys have been. But,
yeah, he's no Mike up short. He's no Mike Pompeo. In other words, he is. Thune is another one of these senators from a deep red state. Now, North Dakota, is it North Dakota or South Dakota? I can't remember off the top of my head.
South Dakota.
Yeah, South Dakota. So, yeah, this is now South Dakota is a little bit of a different state because there are Democrats up there that are more it's like West Virginia. Similarly, like West Virginia, a lot of working class, a lot of people who identify more with the Democratic Party. But up there, the Democratic Party is more conservative in many cases than the Republican Party in the rest of the country. But John Thune won as a one is a Republican, this is a guy who's, this is someone in yet another state where he's won by a lot of votes and he's been put in this position by the NRSC and, he essentially gets in the way of everything. Where he needs to, he is conservative. Where he doesn't need to be, he helps push this agenda of being pro immigration. And he's just a piece of trash.
Yeah, one thing you had mentioned that Claire Grady offered her resignation, which I guess Kirstjen Nielsen had announced apparently on her way out. That's a good thing that was sort of needed for the plan to come together, because
yes,
my understanding of that was that based on the Vacancies Act, like she was going to gum up the works for getting, somebody decent in there. And, she's obviously a wham. And, unless you're talking about Queen Anne, like, yeah, probably not.
Yeah. And she's gone now. I mean, I saw at the very beginning of the week where her resignation had been tendered that Dems were also already going after the, like, Trump's move to remove Kirstjen Nielsen is likely illegal. And then you read the article and it's like, oh yeah, it's not that removing her is illegal, it's that replacing her with somebody other than this whammon who's like an up-and-comer is illegal. But then by the end of the day, that whammon was toast and that was the end of that. So,
well, yeah, maybe she didn't want to, maybe there is some truth to the fact that they're, seriously considering reinstating the child separation policy, in which case she didn't want to, end up like Kirstjen Nielsen, and have that sort of as a stain, quote unquote, on her forever. and, you know, and ultimately end up leaving the administration. Whatever your calculation was, Miss Grady, thank you for your cooperation.
Yeah, maybe the Trump administration just needs to come up with a different way of selling child separation. I mean, you know, the shtick that Obama did this is really kind of fake and gay. And maybe if they did something, you know, like community, we're just organizing communities of non-white third world migrants, and we're making sure that they're organized and, you know, sorted into proper categories as required by the law. And it's going to be done in Mexico. I see that a judge has ordered remain in Mexico stopped. So that's basically done. So 600 people, I guess, were kept in Mexico. So Mexico is really not upholding its end of the deal.
Yeah, well, see, I mean, that was, you know, we can talk about whether or not this is likely to be upheld. But that was my big takeaway from this story that I read in Vox. Yeah, more than 600 asylum seekers are being sent back to Mexico since late January, with more than 250 of those coming in the last 2 weeks as the Department of Homeland Security aggressively expanded its use. It's like, yeah, well, sounds like it needs to be fucking aggressively expanded, like exponentially.
Yeah, like, guy, literally nobody is coming across the border, and no exceptions. I mean, so that sort of brings up another thing. It's like, all right, Stephen Miller's in charge, right? Let's just assume that Stephen Miller's in charge by the reaction from the media and the reaction from the GOP and the reaction from the Democrats and everybody else. Let's just assume that Stephen Miller's in charge. All right, so what changes? We know that remain in Mexico is a good policy, because if these people can be forced to apply for asylum in Mexico as opposed to the United States, their ability to take advantage of our system is greatly diminished. The other thing that was very effective was child separation. So what else does Stephen Miller do? I mean, is the throttle on this wide open? I mean, what are some of the other things that he can do? Because, you know, one of the reasons that we liked Bill Barr was because of all these detention centers that Bill Barr built. One of them was at Guantanamo Bay. Now, I don't know that we're going to get tent city at Gitmo, but hey, you know, that would be one hell of a white pill if that happened. But I mean, Barr is the fucking king of detention centers. So let's get cracking. Like, let's get cracking. I mean, if the government has to subsidize like fucking canvas tents and fucking cots in the desert.
Well, that was
like
that was a big part of Kobach's 3-point plan. And I saw him saying this, you know, in the course of another interview somewhere else. You know, we had audio of his interview with Lou Dobbs, but his part of his thing, and I'm not sure which part of the border, you know, that this is on, but he talks about all of these mobile home trailers that FEMA has for natural disasters and all this other stuff. Apparently there's a bunch of them, enough to set up like multiple small towns. And that's what he called them. He called them processing towns. I'm sure our friends in the media would be looking to, make another comparison.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good idea, but the problem is, and, you know, I'm sure Kobach maybe knows this, but, you know, it takes someone like us to actually put this into words, is that no matter how nice the trailers are, no matter how nice of a piece of land you pick out, no matter how much free food and water and supplies and everything that you give to these people.
No, it could be pristine. But if these people are not fucking on the lam in the United States, then the objective is not being met.
Oh, no. That's also true. But I was also going to say is that no matter how nice you create conditions for these people, their bad living habits and their sort of like troglodyte way of life is going to be seized upon by the media as somehow the fault of white people, and somehow the fault of Trump administration, and somehow the fault of DHS. And there's going to be a certain percentage of these people that are raped, a certain percentage of these people that are going to die in custody because of the simple fact that they're fucking animals. And because they're animals, they're going to get blamed. The Trump administration is going to get blamed for whatever happens in the custody of these people. No matter if he could give them a beautiful set of homes to live in, doesn't matter. So the best solution, I mean, it's great that Chris is suggesting this idea. I'm just pointing out the fact that the bad living conditions of these people, that they, their natural environment that they create for themselves, even given the best opportunities that the first world can provide, is going to turn into a shit show, and the administration is going to get blamed on it. Even though it works, even though the detention works, they got to have these people, they got to have Mexico do this. They got to have these people not even leaving their countries down in Central America. I mean, the key is the linchpin to the whole thing is the southern border of Mexico. So they got to figure out a way to do that. And the White House has got to figure out. I mean, I think detaining these people indefinitely in large camps is great. But you have the most Jewish media in the country to contend with that's going to be reporting on this. And they're going to find the worst situation. And these people create such a horrible situation for themselves. You just have to take a camera down there.
Correct. It'll be like all those high rise projects that went up in the 60s and were imploded 10 fucking years later.
Yeah. Look at all the we can't win. You can't win. This is why there's nothing wrong with white nationalism. Like, we've tried. Like, at least we tried. We've tried trillions of dollars trying to make the life better for these people.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of one of my things, you know, with talking to normies. Like, I think that all the people who said like this shit will never work have been thoroughly vindicated. But, you know, I understand, it's sort of a very human aspiration to want to, you know, take a stab at things like this and all of us living in harmony and, you know, setting things right for America's original sin and whatnot, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, dude, we did it. We've been doing it for a long time. The results are in. They're fucking clear. And I don't want to hear it.
And you're being blamed for the results. You're being blamed for the outcome that your help tried to do to benefit these people. And
the church with no salvation.
Yeah. Yeah. This is that's why this is, you know, I don't, of course, when Trump was like, yeah, I'm going to see what Mexico's doing in a year and then we'll tariff some car. He was on the right path. He didn't follow through on it. And it was such a ridiculous like walk back. But he was on the right path, because if you factor in what we're talking about, which is that these people's conditions are going to make trying to detain them in tents or trailers or fucking whatever luxury apartments is going to be a shit show, man, no matter what. The answer is close the border and punish Mexico. The answer is punish the Central American countries. That is the answer. Trump has to have the balls to fucking follow through on it. The answer is not detaining them. The answer is punishing these countries to the point where they're ready to do a declaration of war on the United States, which they would never do. But you push them to the point of fucking breaking. You don't fucking just keep allowing the people to come live in trailers, because the trailers are probably better than the fucking place that they're living in right now. You don't want to give them conditions that are too nice anyway. Then it's still
that would be the equivalent of somebody, you know, offering, you know, the average working class person like a, you know, $350,000 townhome or something.
Yeah, it would. It would. Oh, my. Yeah. So this is. Yeah. I mean, there are some things that have to be done. There are some things that sound good, but ultimately aren't a good idea. I do think the separation thing, it's like the people that are already here. Yes, you're going to have to do something with the people that are already like, quote unquote, in flight. They're already here. They're already on their way here. You got to do something about it. But ultimately, the root cause of the issue with these countries belching this detritus, that has to be stopped. You got to put some Pepto-Bismol in their fucking stomach or something to get this shit to stop. And in the meantime, deal with the symptoms of the disease while you try to find the cure.
Yeah, you know, and they're talking about, Trump's strategy of cutting off aid, to these three shit heel countries is, you know, it's all carrot and no stick, and it's only going to make the situation worse. It's like, yeah, dude, that's not my problem. We do not spend a fucking $1 trillion on our military every year so that we can be held, for ransom, at gunpoint and fucking coerced into doing all this shit by the likes of El Salvador.
Yeah.
Sorry, dude.
No, we're not doing that. We're not doing that. And the fact that you don't hear these GOP senators coming out and talking about these solutions, it's obvious to everybody they don't want to solve the problem. it's just got to be made painfully obvious to the voters that put these people in office. And, you know, we'll see where this thing goes. Like I said, the timer has been set. We're by no means back on the Trump train, in case anybody was confused. This is a very good development, given that we now know the lay of the land within the administration. And this was definitely a battle that Jared Kushner did not win. All of his people have been, you know, flushed out of DHS. The GOPE is pissed and the media is going insane. So things are fucking good for now. We'll see if it holds. And in order to see a true reversal on Trump's legal immigration policy, you know, this thing that they're saying with the, you know, baked into the speech in the State of the Union and a few times since then, including at CPAC, I got to see cuts. I got to see those H-2Bs, which have doubled under the Trump administration. I got to see those cut. I mean, he's done a good job on cutting the refugees to almost nothing. I think it is nothing. But until we see that, it's like, you know, one article in McClatchy telling me that, you know, Jared Kushner has lost this battle. It's like, I want to see him lose the war.
Yeah, definitely. Or, you know, or President Trump's not going to get reelected. I don't know. You know, like I said, there's, you know, we should try it and meme, you know, him to, you know, sort of get all the negative attention that Bannon got after that Time cover. If I were Stephen Miller, that's something I would probably be looking into, you know, or at least tossing around as an idea.
Yeah. I mean, I wish Stephen Miller had the same PR team that Jared and Ivanka have to start dropping stuff on them, because apparently that was the thing last summer when and there is a lot of anti-Kushner stuff brewing, but not like it was last year. It'd be great if that would start to come back. But these articles are great. The fact that, you know, Trump is getting frustrated with Jared and you know, hopefully.
Yeah, him, her going on Tucker and getting fired. And yeah, these articles about the power struggle, the GOP, you know, predictably coming up gimpy. You know, I'm sure all the people who, you know, who are reading these articles, all the guys, all the people in the base are like, you know, what the fuck is wrong with these people? Like, to a man, they were all a bunch of bullshit. And then you have Cornyn, you know, closing with, I think the White House needs to consult with the Senate before they make nominations, because it's not a given that everybody they nominate is going to be confirmed. No. So I think rather than have the embarrassment for the nominee and for the president or for senators, the thing I just encourage is that there has to be consultation, you know. And he tried to play it off, you know, like he's was not talking about basically Kobach or somebody like him specifically. He you know, it was talking about some of these Fed appointments as well. It's like, yeah, guy, I'm sure the gang in the GOP Senate is just fine with fucking, you know, Stephen Moore being on the Fed.
Yeah,
Herman Cain might have a little bit more trouble, but I don't know if we have time for all that.
Probably not. Yeah. Well, let's kick it over to Albion Dispatches, and we'll be right back here on FTN midweek to talk about Democrats, a little bit of Bill Barr, probably, and some really juicy bottom of the stack stuff. So we'll be right back on Fash the Nation.
Listening to the show that changed your weekend forever. Fash the Nation. Fash the Nation.
This is Atlas, and these are the Albion Dispatches, collected by Alfred the Average, documenting the oppression of native Britons by a hostile elite and its vibrant clients in the epicenter of clown world. We're back. Let's catch up with the absolute clown state of Brexit. Theresa May flew to Brussels to ask for an extension to Article 50 until the 30th of June, which is after the EU Parliament elections. Donald Tusk, the EU President, urged a year's delay to, quote, allow the UK to rethink its Brexit strategy, unquote, and warned that tough conditions would be attached. He further stated that the current withdrawal agreement could not be unpicked under any circumstances. The PM faced a major Commons revolt last night, with 97 Tory MPs voting against any delay to the April 12th leaving date. Almost 80 more abstained, including a string of ministers, Labour backed the Brexit Day delay, helping it pass by 420 votes to 110, but just 131 Tory MPs supported the PM's plan, 40% of the parliamentary party. May can refuse the EU's offer of a long delay, but then MPs could vote to revoke Article 50 and cancel Brexit altogether, unless a delay is agreed. Honk honk. Currently, May is seeking an extension so she can negotiate with Labour's Jeremy Corbyn about a mutually agreeable way to pass a Brexit deal through Parliament. So what's in the discussions with Labour? Under one proposal, the government would agree to allow free votes on key Labour demands, such as customs unions and a second referendum. If at first you don't succeed, vote, vote again. The editorial board of Albion Dispatches is putting their good boy points on another referendum at this stage. It's the same old song when it comes to ceaseless migration into the UK. The Office for National Statistics said that in 2029, numbers in England will reach 60,207,000 if high migration levels continue, and they will. The project is based on the assumption that net migration will continue at 215,000. The most recent recorded figure for current net migration for the 12 months to September 2018 was nearly a third higher at 283,000. Also in 2029, the population of London alone will pass 10 million. The ONS report said, the population of all regions of England are projected to grow by mid-2026. Regions in the north of England are projected to grow at a slower rate than those in the south. The population of England, put at 55,268,000 in 2016, would, under its principal immigration projection, rise by 5.9% to 58,506,000 by mid-2026. But the principal figure used by the ONS is based on net migration of 152,000 a year, a level unknown since the 1990s. Under the high migration estimate, which uses the 215,000 a year figure, the 2026 England population would be 59,172,000, and by 2029 the figure would be 60,207,000. This would mean an increase of 8.9% on 2016 levels. Lord Green of Deddington, chief of the Migration Watch think tank, said, "It's time that people realise just how rapidly our population is growing. The principal projection assumes that the level of international migration to England will be significantly lower than is currently the case, a scenario that is not likely. On the more realistic high migration scenario, England is projected to hit nearly 60 million by 2026. Such population growth is not only detrimental to heritage Britons, it is also an environmental disaster in the making. How many more fields and woodlands will be built up? How many streams and rivers polluted? How many species threatened with habitat loss? Save the bees, say no to refugees." The magic 13-to-50 ratio is valid across the ever-darkening West. Despite being 13% of London's population, blacks make up 50% of murder suspects as well as victims. Let's dive in deeper and examine a few recent cases of low-level African warfare in good old Londinium. From the Mail Online, a man is fighting for his life after being stabbed and robbed in London today as the capital is hit by another wave of knife crime attacks. The man in his late 20s was run over and stabbed by two men in Crossmead, Eltham, southeast London, during a robbery just after 5 p.m. in which his moped was stolen. One arrest has been made. Three more people have been stabbed in the capital today, including two in the north of the capital, in potentially linked attacks. A man in his 20s was stabbed in his leg on High Street in Walthamstow, northeast London, following reports of a fight at around 4:30 p.m. Before that, two other men were attacked in Kilburn, northwest London, this morning, with one, 63, stabbed in the back at around 1:19 a.m. Before a second, aged 39, was stabbed in the stomach a short time later. The latest day of bloodshed in the capital comes after a man in his 20s was killed in a gun and knife attack in East London last night. How very enriching. Oi, do you have a license for that troll? The government has revealed a set of planned extreme measures to sanction tech companies which failed to remove harmful content online, including terrorist content, self-harm, bullying and child pornography, but also extreme pornography, trolling and disinformation. The definition of harmful content includes behaviours which are harmful but not necessarily illegal, and specifically mentions disinformation, extreme pornography and trolling as examples of harmful content. The proposed government powers reportedly include fines, the ability to force third-party companies to shut down anything which directly or indirectly facilitates access to content from a website that's in breach, the ability to downgrade the offending company's results on search engines, the ability to block offending companies' websites in the UK, the ability to make companies hand over any information related to their response to the harmful content, and the ability to hold individual company executives legally liable for content deemed harmful. Fire up those VPNs, chums. Get your big red noses ready for the clowniest news of the fortnight from The Sun. A teacher has been sent to work at a top secondary school despite struggling to read and write. Faisal Ahmed was passed fit by an elite taxpayer-funded training scheme, but he had extreme difficulty with handwriting, reading problems, and issues understanding written tests. The alarm was raised days into his new job, teaching business studies to students at an outstanding school. His headmaster summoned him to a meeting at the start of his first term and suspended him. Mr. Ahmed, who suffers from dyspraxia, a coordination condition, told head Mark Rowland he could hardly write for more than a couple of minutes as it was too painful. Mr. Ahmed, in his 30s, was recruited by Teach First, which gets millions in funding to parachute top graduates into schools. Details of the 2016 scandal emerged after he sued Thomas More Catholic School in Wood Green, North London, for constructive dismissal and disability discrimination after quitting in fury. But legal papers obtained by The Sun show Mr. Ahmed, who was to teach teens for GCSEs and A-levels, lost his tribunal claim and an appeal. In Piss Earth Britain, illiteracy will be mandatory. News for this edition of Albion Dispatches was sourced from Breitbart London and mainstream UK media sources. Tune in to Albion Dispatches in 2 weeks. Heard only on Fash the Nation at therightstuff.biz.
And now, back to Fash the Nation. Heard only on the TRS Radio Network.
We are back. Hope you enjoyed this week's installment of Albion Dispatches, compiled by Alfred the Average and read by Atlas. So the white nationalist hearings were not the only thing that was going on Capitol Hill this week. The Attorney General, William Barr, was up there. He said he gave indications that whatever level of redaction with the Mueller report, it will be released in a week. The process is going along very well, Mr. Barr said during testimony before the House Appropriations Subcommittee on the Justice Department's fiscal 2020 budget request. Sort of an odd place to shoehorn his testimony in, but that's what everyone wanted. Within a week, I will be in a position to release the report to the public, and then I will engage with the chairman of the Judiciary Committees on its release to Congress. He continued in his response to questioning from Representative Jose Serrano, DNY. He said Tuesday that officials would color code restricted information in the report so that the four categories are distinguished and provide explanatory notes for the basis for each redaction, such as identifying something as redacted because of a court order and an ongoing criminal prosecution or grand jury material or classified information or whatever. Barr later was noncommittal on whether he would release the full report to Congress, but signaled a willingness to work with lawmakers to achieve some kind of agreement. Democrats have basically said they'll accept nothing less than a completely unredacted report, which is not, these people are trying to get the Attorney General to break the law in doing so. He did, however, come out and say, I guess this morning, derogatory information about President Donald Trump will not be redacted, and it will be whatever was in Special Counsel Mueller's report will be there.
It's not just about Donald Trump. It's any elected officials.
Yeah. So office holders, quote unquote. That's I'm hoping that there are that's sort of like a double entendre on Barr's part. That's probably not the right term for it, but there's some hidden meaning there.
Yeah, well, it also means, they're celebrating the fact that they think that they're going to get some goods on Trump when in reality maybe there will be, but it could also be some bad news for them as well. I think the color coding is good, though. And, this is another example, like we said in the first half, where you can tell that they are not getting what they want. Like with regard to Stephen Miller and Kirstjen Nielsen, because of the reaction. And the reaction to Bill Barr right now is probably at a 7 or an 8 out of 10. I mean, the hand-wringing, and they're using this new term that Bill Barr was hand-picked by the administration to be the hatchet job. It's like all cabinet secretaries are hand-picked, you fucking morons. Like, but this is the level. This is the level of the discourse in our country right now. Like the level of stupidity, the level of low IQ. There are enough people who buy in. Obviously, it's poll tested. People who buy into the idea that how dare Donald Trump hand pick his attorney general? I mean, it's just fucking insane because they're running with this talking point. Donald Trump's attorney general. Yeah, it's like, of course,
they're all bitching about, you know, that memo that Barr wrote that was, I think, widely circulated in a lot of the major newspapers. And all that he was saying really is that if the Department of Justice is going to start charging the president of the United States with obstruction of justice, for doing things that he, you know, was unequivocally has the clear statutory authority to do and is essentially the conduct of his duties, you know, the decisions that he makes about how he executes his duties and responsibilities and you know, runs the executive branch, that's very bad precedent. And that was just him issuing a plain statement of fact and his opinion as, you know, someone who is a DOJ institutionalist. And, you know, he was brought in to, I think, do some of the right things, and also, you know, do it very competently. Now, am I going to agree with everything that Mr. Barr does? Surely not. But he seems to be doing what he's there to do.
Well, and we always thought, I remember sitting in Sven's basement. We were there for the last episode we did in the studio. I think Ethnarch was on there. I think you were away that weekend. And essentially, I was like, we're putting a moratorium on Bill Barr until something else happens with this guy. Because what was always, attractive about him as a candidate for this office was his detention of people in Gitmo, but not detainee,
infected Haitians.
Yes, exactly. The anti-refugee stance. He also went around Congress and got a wall built during HW. And so it was beyond his abilities, his purported abilities to do something about the Mueller probe. And so he seems to be, as you said, doing some things competently. Now, I would love for Mr. Barr to start picking up where Jeff Sessions left off, because what we have said repeatedly, now maybe nobody's going to be as good as Jeff Sessions on the immigration stuff, but what we've said repeatedly is that whoever the AG is works closely with whoever the DHS secretary is. And those two have to work really well together. So whoever Trump picks to replace Kirstjen Nielsen, it ought to be someone who can cooperate and work very well with Barr on coordinated efforts to cull immigration, specifically with the DOJ and the asylum cases and everything else. So,
yeah. I mean, obviously, Kobach is at the top of the wish list. If Homan really is in consideration, I would say that, by my calculation, it would be a feather in his cap that he's, likely looking at a far less contentious confirmation, being that he was a holdover from the Obama administration who, as I speculated some time ago, was sort of bristled at the fact that he was presented from doing his job. The other interesting thing that Barr said in his testimony on Capitol Hill is that he is very curious and he does plan on kicking some rocks as far as what the genesis of this whole counterintelligence operation is, the probe, the dossier, all of that stuff.
Yeah, well, whether he will follow through on that in a meaningful way or not, time will tell. I saw this morning that there's a report out there that he's forming a team to probe the FBI and actions in the Russia investigation. And he did say in a contentious hearing this morning that spying did take place on the Trump campaign, which is pretty significant. And it's one of the reasons why the reaction to him has been so negative today. It was like a 5 or a 6, and now it's up to about a 7 or an 8. And, you know, some of the other reasons why this guy has gotten a lot of pushback, too, is this is something that you told me privately. And then it came up and I wasn't sure if it was true. And then someone emailed me about it. And this was about this conversation that you believed went down between Barr and Mueller. And it actually went down exactly as you thought it would, which is that soon after Bob Barr was sworn in, he had a meeting with Mueller and Weissman. And Mueller has deferred the tactics of the investigation to Weissman. This is something that we had talked about pretty heavily. And it was Weissman that wanted the special counsel to keep going, at least through the Roger Stone trial later this year, in the hope of eliciting more potential information on collusion. Barr did not agree. And this is what you said to me, is that Bill Barr sat down with Bob Mueller and was basically like, all right, Bob, cut the shit. What do you got for me? What's here? What are you going to do? And I think Mueller basically was like, look, there's really nothing here. And that's why it was kind of kicked over to Weissman, because Weissman was the guy that was going to take it over and make it a very Jewish political operation. It was already a Jewish political operation, but even more Jewy than it already was. And Barr essentially said, time to wrap it up if there are no other avenues of investigation. And this meeting was reported in the media, but it was lost in a lot of noise. So that was the little battle that I guess took place between these guys. And the plan was to have it go on forever. Whether or not, you know, Mueller really wanted to continue to, because Mueller does at the end of the day care about his reputation, I think. I mean, and he didn't deliver the goods. And so the longer he was in there not delivering the goods, the worse it was for him. Weissman doesn't give a shit. Weissman can weather all that if he wants.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment that Barr certainly cares about his reputation. And who knows, maybe somewhere deep down, he still cares a little bit about justice being served. But yeah, I suspect Barr was like...
You mean Mueller cares about his reputation?
right.
Yeah, okay. All right.
I suspect Barr was like, yeah, you know, this is it. This is what you got. All right. So, you know, let's not make a mess of things here. We're going to do this gracefully, but this is over.
Yeah, well, and you could see that the plan, I mean, why would the plan have been Mueller brings in Weissman and then stands Weissman up at the head of the investigation for like a few weeks? I mean, the plan was to keep this thing going forever. And, you know, purportedly, allegedly, Barr was like, yeah, what do you got going on here? Let's wrap this up. And, you know, this is why Mueller strategically kicked a lot of this stuff up to the Southern District of New York and Eastern District of New York. And I don't know, man, I'm really hoping and praying that some of those chickens come home to roost at some point for Kushner part of this administration.
Oh, that would be so delicious. You know, I hope that that's ultimately what forces him out. I mean, if they end up, you know, going with all of this probe and endless investigations and Kushner is the only real casualty, then kind of all's well that ends well.
Well, I mean, where did it happen in the Old Testament that a Jew subverted a goy leader and then the Jew goes to jail? That could very well happen with this. I think it would be, I mean, look, if the Democrats are successful in going after Jared Kushner's clearance and they uncover some stuff there that was not on the up and up and Jared loses his clearance, the Trump administration will just shift him to the campaign, which is not really a good thing for us in the long run. But if Jared is indicted, or if Jared, these things start to heat up in New York, that's, I think, going to be enough to get rid of him completely. Like, Trump is not even going to want that guy on. It's just like your father at that point. I mean, that's the way Trump's opinion is going to be. Hopefully that'll be enough, because like we said in the book, the whole concern with Trump was like when they start getting too close for comfort on Jared's problems, it's like, this isn't something that I really want people doing. But we don't even know if there could be perhaps some things up in SDNY or EDNY that are related to Trump himself. I mean, really don't know that. But I guess what you're saying about this report is that this derogatory info will not be redacted. But what I want to know is, in this 400 page report, what details will be given about what stuff has been kicked upstate? It's supposed to say that, right? It's supposed to say the decisions made to charge and not to charge and why, right? I mean, shouldn't there be a section in there about the things that were found that got sent elsewhere?
I mean, not if that is now part of a further ongoing investigation.
Yeah, probably that part would be redacted.
It's only stuff that's settled as far as the question of whether to charge or not to charge. I mean, I'm just assuming here.
Yeah, it may say something to the effect that this redacted was found with this senior administration or official, redacted, and was referred to here. It's an ongoing investigation, redacted, will probably be what it says. I guess we'll see.
Yeah, we will see. You know, as always, there will be no shortage of stuff for us to be keeping track of on that note. You want to talk some 2020 Democrats?
Yeah. So I see Eric Shilwell, I'm going to nuke the Ruralite, is running for president now, and he's unionizing.
Another county heard from.
Yes. He is unionizing his campaign. He says on Colbert, "I see a country in quicksand, unable to solve problems and threats from abroad, unable to make life better for people here at home." Well, the threats from abroad are bringing people here to our home that don't belong here. Eric Shilwell should know that, living in California. "I'm ready to solve these problems, and I'm running for president of the United States." Swalwell added, "Boy, did it feel good to say that." It's like, bro, you're not going anywhere.
I mean, even all these articles, from Salon and all those types of websites, it's just like, but why the...
Yeah, it's like, oh, look, here's a white guy trying to make it in today's Democratic Party. Oh, this guy's from California. He's not a working class dude. He grew up in wine country. Like, well, I mean, what does this guy have to offer anybody? He is someone that they were grooming. He's always at Pelosi's side everywhere you go. Someone that they're grooming, yeah. but it's for like a strategy slowly becoming OBE.
Yeah, I mean, he's like you said, he's just another white guy, but he doesn't even rise to the level of a Martin O'Malley, who was the governor of a state. You know, there were these other white guys who, you know, had to, you know, potentially way more legitimate aspirations, you know, with the having served terms as governor, or maybe like a Chris Van Hollen or somebody like that. And it's just like, dude, don't you get it yet? Like, I understand, you know, maybe he feels that he gets like so much media exposure, or maybe he's just, you know, some people run for president, because he's fairly young. Some people run for president just to, it's unless you make a fool of yourself or have some sort of huge scandal, it's not necessarily detrimental to have a little bit more name exposure. But I don't know. It just kind of doesn't really make any sense. And I don't think he's going to be welcome among Democrats. We just don't need it's never mind the fact that you're just another, boring white guy. Like, we don't fucking the country's full. This primary's full.
Yeah, well, I think as you pointed out, it's to raise his stature among Democrats. He's relatively new. He is a white guy. He, as far as I know, is not Jewish. And he is someone who is trying to make a name for himself, because no matter how brown the Democratic Party gets, they're going to have to have semi-competent white guys like doing some part of the bit. And they seem to have him, because he tries to flex his sort of intel, bona fides or whatever. And he's just going to be another establishment, deep state, intelligence community adjacent Adam Schiff type of guy that they're grooming. So that whatever white men are left in the Democratic Party still see someone that looks like them who is saying things that, you know, I don't know, maybe resonate with them or something. That's the only purpose that Swalwell serves.
Yeah, like I was saying, you know, having Schiff and Nadler out there as the primary henchman is kind of a risky move. It's like, hey, come on, where's your goy front man? I know you know this trick.
Yeah, and it's like Nadler has the triple parentheses around his name on Twitter. It's like, dude, I mean, does somebody have a talk with him and just be like, guy, you gotta dial it back. You still gotta get guys like Shilwell in there. So that it's a little bit more of an easy game to pull off.
Yeah, I mean, because it does, you know, it's sort of like a basic bitch talking point, but there comes a time when, like, it's like, okay, I couldn't, you know, maybe this was the case for blacks at one point or whatever, deciding whatever political party. But for whites, they're not going to deal with this in their own country. Like, it's like I couldn't run for fucking dog catcher in this party and actually win, you know, because as I've said before, like I'm the bad guy and all of these people's, you know, little tales and tropes and shibboleths, like. You know, I don't imagine, unless you're just like insanely cucked, you're going to stop supporting that political organization
eventually,
before too long.
Eventually. And that's another reason why they have to have Swalwell as one of the also rans. It's almost the Democratic Party has reached the point at which it needs token whites to run for these offices. I mean, I'm not joking. And it's a really sad state of affairs, but it's true. Like Swalwell is a token white. Because if they push all the white men out of the running and say you're not welcome, I mean, the whole jig is up very quickly. They got to have some of these guys out there, like I said. So whoever's left in the Democratic Party who's a white man who hasn't figured this shit out yet has somebody that looks like them to keep the game going just a little while longer.
Yeah, well, speaking of the sordid state of affairs in the Democratic Party these days, so you have an article here outlining how John Lewis is the most coveted endorsement of this 2020 primary cycle. I mean, as far as, you know, everyone was doing the national action bit last week, but, you know, this is an actual elected official, and he was... you know, wasn't he part of the Freedom Riders or whatever the fuck? So that's why everyone's always all over this guy's.
Wasn't he also spat on?
I guess he went to Selma and got his ass fucking beat a little bit.
Didn't he also accuse Andrew Breitbart of spitting on him during that march?
remember when they were passing Obamacare and they're walking over from the one office building, Nancy Pelosi, you know, holding that big like novelty cartoon gavel. I think he was the guy that said he was spit on, you know, and in that situation. And then it became a big row and a row. And
Oi, mate, row. Yeah, big row with John Lewis. Yeah, John Lewis.
And then Breitbart was like, he was like, look, dude, there were fucking cameras everywhere. So, like, if you can prove that this happened, I'll donate $100,000 to the United Negro College Fund. And then that was the end of it.
Yeah, it ended pretty quickly. But yeah, this is how John Lewis is known. And of course, the Congressional Black Caucus is totally controlled opposition. I mean, blacks haven't like caught on to them, for the most part, haven't caught on to this yet. And, you know, this is something that we pointed out before, which is that whoever makes it through the primary on the Democratic side is going to have to garner some large portion of the black vote. So a lot of this anti-white shit that you see, of course, it's driven by just the general like anti-white zeitgeist, but it's also about attracting these black voters. And, you know, John Lewis is kind of the key to all of that. So whoever he endorses is going to be it's going to be a very big deal. Whoever Obama endorses for the most part is going to be a significant big deal. But Obama has been kind of fucking quiet. But yeah, yeah, remember.
Yeah, I saw that article that you had. You know, I think he probably favors Kamala as sort of the 2.0 version of Barack Obama. But, you know, he can't leave lunch pail Joe out there high and dry. That would be pretty bad optics.
Well, dude, Obama has been leaving lunch and Michelle Obama have both been leaving Joe Biden out there high and dry with this whole Me Too shit. I guess Michelle was at some event or something, and she had an opportunity to say something about Joe Biden and not a fucking thing. And Obama has sort of said nothing. I mean, they're just going to sit on the side because they don't want I mean, Biden was a useful tool for them to get into office because they still needed to get some of the white vote. But he's not going to be a useful tool now. There's going to be no quid pro quo. There's going to be no back scratching on the other. Dude, the Obamas are waiting for the right moment. And I think Obama will probably endorse someone like Kamala Harris.
I think he probably will endorse Harris, but I don't know. I have a creeping suspicion that he'll do it. You know, not when it's a foregone conclusion, but basically, you know, sort of all but inevitable. He'll come out and be like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was reading here about John Lewis in 2007. I had forgotten about this, but now it's all coming flooding back. In 2007, Lewis initially endorsed Clinton and then switched his endorsement to Obama in February of 2008, which is a devastating blow for Hillary Clinton and rocket fuel for Obama.
As soon as he felt that Obama's campaign had any viability at all, he was like, yeah, I'll risk angering the Clinton machine to support this guy. Yeah. I'm black. Fuck it.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll see how this goes. I mean, it really is the key to the whole thing. And I mean, Bernie doesn't have to do this. He's trying to be somewhat attractive to the Democrat or the black community. But, you know, like we've been saying, Bernie can sort of just go on forever. And I've seen a bunch of articles this week about everyone should just consider Bernie the front runner. And he's raising a lot of money. He is more popular than he was in 2016. So Bernie is now a bigger problem than he was back then to the establishment, which is going to really throw a wrench into their mix. Because without Bernie, where does that vote go? You know, where does this support for Bernie Sanders go? If Bernie didn't exist, where would that vote be? It wouldn't be with Biden. Where would they be? Warren? With spread out among other new Democrats, where would that support go?
Yeah, I mean the more policy wonk people in his camp, I assume would flock to Warren. You know, they're held in sort of the same regard as far as that. You know, the people who just, you know, got wrapped up in feeling the burn. I don't know, you know, Beto, whatever is the flavor of the month. You know, there will have people who are just, you know, they don't have the real, you know, feel the burn convictions, though most of them do, which is why it's going to get as contentious as it's going to.
Yeah, well, we're not far away from the first debates. I've seen some announcement that's not far off. There are going to be some primary debates coming up very soon. So that'll be something that we sort of stay tuned for. I saw also that the reparations have come back into center focus. This is great. This is mostly Cory Booker. But I think it was it Castro that came out and was like the only guy out of all of these guys who said, No, I'm actually going to give payments to black people. Do I have that right? Was it Castro was the only one? Everybody else sort of had like this, I believe in reparations, but it's just going to be Dem programs for everybody.
Yeah, yeah. It was Castro, you know, registering it at 1% or wherever he is. Yeah, he came out, you know, and everyone's asking the specific question about direct payments. Yeah, that was his line that he thought was going to, you know, vault him from 1% to 5%. Like, you know, we compensate people when we take their property.
Why would we not compensate people who were property?
Yeah, yeah.
Just give me the nomination now.
Well, speaking of Castro, and then we'll go back to Booker in the reparation stuff, because David Santacarla had some fucking hilarious audio on this. So something that's been in the stack for a while is Julian Castro is the very first Democratic candidate who's put out a real immigration proposal. Nobody else has. They're all essentially just not, they're too afraid to say where the line is on immigration. Otherwise, they signal for open borders. And I mean, I've actually made this argument in private. I don't know if I've done it on a show yet, but that's actually one of the reasons why Trump feels like he can be advised to be in the middle on immigration. If Trump actually had someone on the Democratic side putting competitive policy proposals out on immigration who was fearless in doing so, now that Democrat would get eaten alive by the base, so they can't. But it would force Trump to actually be more competitive. But when you have literally everybody, including Castro, saying we should just open up the borders and be done with it, like, let's just fucking do this damn thing, that allows Trump to just sort of be like, yeah, there's a huge crisis and like we need to do something, but I don't have to do anything right away until it got so bad that, yeah, you got to do something because it's going to cost you the White House in 2020. But Castro is the first person that's officially put out some sort of proposal, I guess. People first is his policy.
Yeah. So according to this this Voxplainer, I read about it. Yeah. So his proposal promises reversals of signature Trump policies like the travel ban and reduction in refugee resettlement. But also it goes much further than that in dismantling immigration enforcement. In many ways, it seeks to unravel the post 9/11 immigration enforcement system, which made it legally riskier than ever to live in the U.S. as an unauthorized immigrant. Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's really that risky, but moving on. Most notably, Castro proposes to repeal the provision of U.S. law that makes illegal entry into the U.S. a federal crime, which has been on the books since 1929, but has only been routinely enforced in the 21st century. Prosecuting illegal entry often referred to by 1325, the relevant section of Chapter 8 of the U.S. Code, gave the Trump administration the power to separate families in 2018 by referring parents for criminal prosecution. The fact that over the last several years, the system has been weaponized by the Trump administration to go after immigrants and the chaos that has been created under 1325, I believe, is the wrong way to go for the country, Castro told Vox. And his response to, quote unquote, go the opposite way is to undo the legal underpinning that made it possible. Under Castro's plan, an immigrant crossing the U.S. into the U.S. without papers, whether he was seeking asylum in the U.S. or coming for some other reason, would not be committing a federal crime. If caught by Border Patrol agents, he or she would be detained for a brief amount of time. But if she didn't raise any red flags, they would be released into the U.S. with a case management system to check up on their whereabouts pending an immigration hearing. If they didn't qualify for some form of legal status like asylum, you know, there's a million different kinds that this country doles out like candy, they'd ultimately be ordered deported from the U.S. Yeah, sure, Julian. Being in the U.S. without papers would still be a civil offense, the federal equivalent of a traffic ticket, and deportation would still be the penalty. That's what Castro points out. Distinguishes his plan from, quote unquote, open borders. Some of the sort of bullet points. DHS would stop signing agreements with local law enforcement agencies known as 287G agreements to help enforce immigration law, undoing one of the key tools that the 21st century presidents have used as a force multiplier. Immigration detention would only be used in the most serious cases, and since the plan promises to end the use of private prisons, which count for the overwhelming majority of immigration detention facilities, wouldn't really have much flexibility as to what those cases were, immigration courts would be removed from the attorney general's authority. This is something that we've been talking about. These people have been pining for. Right now, immigration courts are at best quasi-independent. They're under the DOJ, and the attorney general has the power to set court precedent and regulate caseload. This is one of the things that Beauregard was a master at. Yeah, Vox even says under Jeff Sessions and his successors, the Trump DOJ has used these powers aggressively. The Castro proposal, echoing a call that's been gaining steam among immigration lawyers and advocates, would turn immigration courts into Article I courts. You know, sort of like the rest of the judicial system. Oh, yeah. These people would love that.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Putting immigration even further into this purview of the judiciary. And this is what they want. And another thing that this whole process of making it just a simple civil penalty, like a traffic ticket. Oh, yeah, we're still going to deport them, which he tries to tout as being serious and like different from open borders. But the reality is then you can't. The person comes back in again without a deportable offense. Like they come in and they have a traffic ticket. It's not like the deportation would be. The first deportation is the thing that predicates every subsequent deportation, right?
So, yeah, so, one of the actually reasonable things about our immigration system, of course, like so much, it's not enforced properly, is that the first one, reentry after deportation, is a felony, right?
Yes. Yeah. And then recidivism gets you put on the pathway for expedited removal when you continue to do this. And then it's like no questions asked, adios. This is what his proposal is like you get 1 trillion chances to try to fucking get it right.
Like, yeah, he was actually on CNN talking about his brilliant plan.
Fenced in a pen, treated like animals. I don't believe that we should do that. I have a different vision. I believe that we should go back to how this was handled before about 2004. I believe that we should.
Meaning it should be civil. You see these as civil infractions. You don't see them as criminal infractions. You know what people will say. You have to come to this country legally.
Well, that's why my immigration plan also includes improving our legal immigration system.
Oh, I'm sure it does.
You know what? I have a vision for this country, too. And that is that we go back to a time prior to 1804. How's that sound? Can we go back to that far? Can we go back to the free white men of good moral character only? Because that's what was originally intended. This fucking fuck this nation of immigrants bullshit. Free white men of good moral character. That's my vision for the country.
1790, brah.
Yeah. 1790. Yeah, well, I was doing 1804 because he said 2004. So I was like, let's rewind the clock about another 200 years, Castro. What were you doing back then? What was your family doing back then?
Yeah, so here he is responding to what little pushback he shockingly got.
I'm asking people to do is to recognize that this president's cruelty has failed. He said about a year ago, this administration said that if we would just be cruel enough to treat little children so badly, so cruelly that we would take them away from their mothers, that would deter more families from coming. And instead, the opposite is true. More families are coming today. So I'm saying that we've tried cruelty. I believe that we should try compassion and that we're still going to have a secure border. Our border.
How? Let's talk about that, because I mean, this is where I think that the president will come after you, as will Republicans, because when you say that immigration detention will become a rarity, they say, well, you want open borders. They believe you must arrest people who are trying to enter the country illegally.
This is just a Republican talking point. You're still going to have all of the Border Patrol that are on the border. You're still going to have, they have 654 miles of fencing right now out of a 2,994 mile border. We have helicopters, we have airplanes.
But when people show up, if you don't detain them, what are you going to do with them?
Well, we're going to process them. And it's true, we still have the option to deport them. An open border, to say open borders is a complete falsity, because you still have the option to deport people.
Oh, man. Yeah, this guy. No wonder this guy is in, like, he's not charismatic at all. It's just like boring monotone. He looks like a fucking goober anyway. But yeah, it's like,
he looks like he could be Southeast Asian, as much as a fucking beaner. He's one of those kind of guys. But yeah, speaking of,
So another thing he says, which is kind of funny, is like that cruelty hasn't worked. It's like, no, cruelty did work. That's the only the only thing that translates for these people, because
it was tried and failed. It's like, it really wasn't, though.
No, it's like you could graph it out in detail, the indexing on how compassionate we have been to how bad the situation has become. And, you know, of course, he doesn't give a shit about that. And his whole thing is like, let's be more compassionate. Oh, whoops. 10 years goes by. Border crossings increased by 6,000,000%. Oh, whoops. Too late. I mean, that's the plan, right? Let's have some compassion. Oh, I didn't expect this to be the outcome. Too late. This is the last lap on American demographics. This is what Castro is all about.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you'll still have the Border Patrol. Yeah, this fucking story from CNN, from the top of the stack that we sort of glossed over. Yeah, I mean, you know, the headline itself, you know, and I tweeted this out. It's like, just let it sink in for a moment. On Friday, during his visit to Calexico, Trump told Border Patrol agents behind the scenes not to let any immigrants in if ordered by a judge to respond, "Sorry, judge, I can't do it. We don't have the room," two sources told CNN. When the agents later asked their commanding officers about the remarks, their superior said policy was to obey the law and that they would face personal liability if they complied with Trump's orders, according to the network. You know, I mean, this is sort of the point that I've been harping on. Like, the Border Patrol is there, but they're not. They're under what circumstances are they standing there just being like, no, you're not coming in here? Like, even the people, even the Mexicans who, you know, these Mexican dudes who aren't non-impactable, meaning they can be afforded or deported rather. I mean, are they not first taken into custody and brought into the United States before that happens? So, like, who does the Border Patrol actually fucking stop from coming in here?
It's a customer relationship organization within the federal government. That's all it is. And it's staffed by half are Hispanics. Half of the people in the Border Patrol.
Oh, yeah.
Are
no, Hispanics. everyone except the head, Fred, who's a white woman, a steamboat of a woman, to borrow an old line of yours.
Jesus.
Everyone aside from that, yes, is literally a beaner.
Oh my god. Yeah, and it's horrible. These people are there to, like, reach out a hand and hand them a towel when they climb out of the Rio Grande. It's like that bad.
Oh yeah. Speaking of needing to, you know, or in Bernie's case, perhaps not needing so much to appeal to the black vote. It doesn't mean he's not trying. I guess during a campaign stop in Iowa, the Vermont senator was asked about his position on imprisoned people participating in elections. "I think that is absolutely the direction we should go," Sanders told at a town hall in Muscatine, Iowa, according to the Des Moines Register. Currently, only Maine and Vermont let felons retain their voting rights while incarcerated, which the senator noted on Saturday. "In my state, what we do is separate. You're paying a price. You committed a crime. You're in jail. That's bad. But you're still living in American society and you have a right to vote. I believe in that. Yes, I do." His position was celebrated by advocates for criminal justice reform, including Sean King, a longtime supporter who spoke at the candidate's 2020 launch rally.
I thought you were going to say Jared Kushner, because their policies align perfectly right now with the felon voting.
Yeah. Just let people vote from fucking in jail, dude. Yeah. My democracy. Fucking kill. Like, why don't we just fucking blow my brains out now?
Yeah, wait till they start doing online voting for everybody. Just, it's all online, bro. It's totally secure election. It's going to be great.
Yeah. Yeah. But it definitely needs to be mobile accessible, you know, for all those people who are online, but have like never seen a real fucking computer in their life.
Oh, yeah. Totally mobile accessible. Yeah, it's going to be great. So let's do some of the stuff with the reparation stuff. So, yeah, this is an issue that I thought was going away. It hasn't gone away, you know, and I'm glad that it hasn't gone away, because it's great that they're doing this, because it seems like Cory Booker's the one that's bringing it back, because the first wave of reparations was, like I said earlier, it's this meme, essentially, where we're going to just do a bunch of them programs, and blacks are like, hey, yo, hold up. Are you actually going to do something for like black people? I mean, this is what happened with Kamala and the Root. And she's like, well, I mean, it's a rising tide lifts all boats. It's like, no, bitch, that's not what we want. But Cory Booker is going back to the trough on slavery reparations. And this is actually a pretty good idea, not the reparations, but what he is doing. And it's something that the Republicans could learn from, if there were any Republicans out there willing to learn, and I don't think there are many, is that he's come up with legislation, as the Washington Times puts it, to pave a path for slavery reparations. Now, what he's done is he's proposing legislation that would commission a study to look into reparations and then come up with, you know, proposals. And of course, the study is going to be just totally bullshit. But the thing about this bill that you could apply to any number of issues on our own side is that it is just a study, and he can sell it as just a study. It's like, what are you against a study for? What do you want to? You don't want to be against a study. We're not actually voting on the reparations. We just want to study.
Yeah. And then when are you against ideas?
Yeah. And then when the study comes back, then the study is, of course, going to tell you like how black people have been harmed and how it really won't cost white people that much money and, you know, to give them reparations and they deserve it. And, you know, this will be a one time thing, but it'll really go on forever and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a great shoe in the door, because then once the results of the study come back in to say whatever they want them to, then they can say like, well, look, we did this study and it says that we have to act. So are you against this now? And this is a great.
Well, it's something we've been commenting on for a long time. A lot of them don't even, you know, or they pretend not to understand how their opponents operate. But yeah, the GOP, you know, and sort of the right in particular is definitely bad at incrementalism.
Yes. Yeah, because a lot of people would look at this as like a cuck, you know, but nobody from the left is coming out and calling Cory Booker a cuck for doing this, for commissioning a study. Now, I think most people probably realize, maybe some more woke blacks realize, that this is sort of a cuck in some ways. It could be a cuck, like, oh, man, this guy just this is just a way of keeping the issue alive, and he looks like he's doing something.
Well, they don't
about
understand
it.
How this shit works. Like the study, you know, and it needs to go and be circulated through the think tanks and make its way to the media and blah. You know, there's a lot of, you can get a lot of mileage out of a study if done right.
Well, I have bad news for the people that really like Tulsi Gabbard. She has signed on as a co-sponsor of this study. For reparations. Oosh. So yes, oosh is right. Mr. Booker is teaming up with Rep. Sheila Jackson Lee as well, Texas Democrat, who took over the Maine reparations legislation after former Rep. John Conyers Jr., the longtime chief sponsor, left Congress in 2017 amid a Me Too fueled inquiry into his behavior. Mr. Booker on the campaign trail had complained about how the reparations conversation was playing out, saying it was being turned into a checkbox issue for candidates and activists. Well, David Santacarla has provided us with some fantastic audio of Mr. Booker talking about this checkbox issue with just a guy that has gotten roasted from the Root so hard on Twitter. This fuck dude, when you see this this fucking guy interviewing Booker, oh my god. But here's the audio of this. Here we go right now.
A number of candidates that are talking about reparations.
Yes.
Do you support reparations for black people?
I support reparations. I support economically designed programs with race as a conscious part of them that balance the scales and address past ills, not just slavery.
What does that plan look like? And what are you proposing to do to explore reparations for black people?
Well, I don't have all the answers.
And I just want to be perfectly clear, because many people are not sure where your position is. You definitely support reparations for black people.
Yes.
But right now, you are providing these other alternative plans until there's a comprehensive way to get those reparations for black
yes.
people, just and to be clear.
Yeah, but yes. But.
Do you feel some of the presidential candidates are pandering to black people about the reparations conversation?
Yeah, look.
Hold up. Watch the video. It's on Santa Carla's Twitter. Hopefully me talking about this doesn't get him fucking axed, but
the guy Carla. Who interviewed Kamala was definitely more sophisticated. He was like, what about them cash payments though?
yeah, the cash payments specifically for the black people. It's like, oh my god. Somebody from Twitter literally has a caved in head, smacks lips. So when are we going to get that check, homie?
Oh, man. Yeah. And well, it doesn't surprise me to see Booker be the one, going back to the well and sort of resurrecting this. He's got to get some track position. So, you know, it means rolling the, you know, you got to gamble a little bit. Two tires, no tires. Got to do something. Stay yeah. out.
Well, I love that this keeps coming back as an issue and it just won't go away. I mean, all these issues are this is the most non-traditional election cycle, I think, that we're going to see in our lifetimes, because usually these issues are there right out of the gate and then they get box checked, as Booker puts it, and then neatly put away. And then it shifts to who loves Israel, who is going to get serious and tough on immigration, who thinks Republicans are racist, and then that's sort of it. And
you feeling they're going to check all the fucking boxes before the debates even start?
And then be I've already talked about that. I support reparations, blah, 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 blah. It's like, yeah, but Corey, it's like, yes, but. So bad. They're not going to let this go. It's like you put all these people into these people into these positions at the news media, on television, you've given them all this money and, you know, these positions in society. You think these issues are going to go away now? No. You got Congress bulb bringing this shit up every 5 seconds. I mean, like, what is that going away? These issues aren't disappearing. This is great. This is great. I love every minute of it.
No, it's going to be incredible. I'm anxiously awaiting listening to Tedious after we get done here. I understand some congratulations are in order.
Oh, for whomst?
For, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Oh, God. I don't know if they even talked about it. I haven't listened yet. Maybe they did. But yeah, he is now the PM of Israel. And what, this is like fifth term for this guy? Longest prime minister in history, I guess, according to
this. I mean, I got to say, my congratulations are heartfelt and sincere. I view this as a positive development.
Why is that? Because
it'll continue to drive the wedge and draw this contrast between, what happens in Israel. And I'm sure Benny Gantz was going to be, doing a lot of the same shit as far as Israel being a Jewish state and blah, blah, blah. Although, he was going to be more the optics cuck school of thought. But
yeah, I mean,
just for those things, I think it's probably good.
Yeah, I mean, it would not have worked. I mean, Trump would have been, Trump and Kushner would have been sent sort of back to the drawing. I mean, what does Kushner have to do if Netanyahu loses? I mean, sure, Kushner is going to go try to work with his opposition, maybe, if he'll even talk to him. But Netanyahu sort of gives this boost to Jared Kushner, and in this, you know, if that gets Jared out of the immigration stuff, though, because, see, it's always a double edged sword, right? Like Netanyahu loses and then Jared's like, well, I got nothing to do now. Hey, Stephen, I'm going to come help. You know, Donald says, whereas now that Netanyahu has won, it's like, all right, Jared, why don't you pack your bags and fucking head overseas now? It's always
Jared Kushner. He is fighting for his.
Jesus Christ. Yes. Oh, man.
Yeah. So I don't know. Why not just keep it going? Yeah, I thought this was interesting. This was actually in Yahoo News. There was this guy offering a commentary on it. Ofer, O-F-E-R. I don't know how to say that that Hebe name. Ofer Salzberg. I don't know. You'd think it might be Offer, but I don't know. I'm just going to say Ofer. You're 0 for 109, Doge. 0 for Salzburg from the International Crisis Group think tank said Netanyahu understood the right wing had a built-in advantage in Israel and so could stick with his base. The right wing bloc is predicted to have around 65 seats compared with 55 for the center left. Similar to the makeup of the outgoing parliament, even before the election, all the smaller right-wing parties had pledged to back Netanyahu for prime minister, meaning his victory was always likely. He demonstrated again his mastery of alliance building among the different political tribes of Israel. He is unmatched in this. Dore Gold, a former advisor to Netanyahu, said the secret of his success is that he understands the DNA of the Israeli voter.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, of course. Well, wouldn't it be nice if to be a political candidate in a country like America, all you have to do is just understand viscerally the DNA of your constituents, 100% of them.
Yeah, this guy, you know, he drew some interesting comparisons between domestic U.S. politics and you know what's going on over there, basically saying that you know, these people in Israel can't have come to view the left as an existential threat, which I don't know, who knows if it is or isn't. I mean, later on the guy I read another article, it's like, yeah, Benny Gantz, or Gantz, or whatever, however it's to be said, you know, he was an IDF bigwig, so I doubt he's just going to be like, you know, letting in Palestinians left and right, and then you know, bringing back the Ethiopian Jews or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll see how this sort of plays out. We're at over two and a half, almost 2.5 hours. So probably ought to shut it down here and leave some for the final.
Oh, God.
What's up? Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah. There's a bunch of bottom of the stack stuff, but probably have to wait for this weekend show.
Yeah. No, let's shut it down.
All right, let's shut it down. All right, guys. Well, this weekend, we got Mike Enoch joining us to talk about Kushner Inc. and probably a whole bunch of other shit between now and the weekend. So we will catch you guys on Sunday.